So just befriend the weak. And break another heart this Welcome to This Week in Wrestling, Indies and International. I'm Pete, and of course I'm joined by Timothy. Timothy, how you doing, man?
Phenomenal. Doing great as always. Looking forward to beer events. I'm going to be going out to San Diego for a big beer event here coming up soon. I need to get to some wrestling shows, but I unfortunately have not carved out any as of right now, but I will... let you know when I do buy some tickets. I'll let everyone know when I do buy some tickets or officially confirm on some shows. But there's some good stuff from AWS in March, it looks like. I'm really liking their card in March. But there's a Maverick Pro show that I may head out to coming up, I think, next week. Otherwise, I mean, Super Bowl weekend, there is a big vegan event happening at the Smorgasbord. It's kind of a food truck festival that's every Sunday in downtown LA, so I think I'm going to go check that out on Sunday before the big game. Otherwise, pretty good. How you been, Pete?
Doing good. I went to an AECW Anarchy Championship Wrestling show, and of course I didn't make it through all the way. I have to be at work at 5 in the morning on Monday, right? So I get there at 6. The show starts at 6. 9:30 rolls around. And they introduced Scott Summers into their ring of whatever, kind of like their Hall of Fame. So he's about to cut a promo, and then there's three more matches.
Oh, why did he what time is this? That? What time did they? What time was that that you said?
9:30. So 3.5 hours Ooh. Into it, we're getting a promo, and three more matches left. It's like, what's the point? I mean. What is the point of running? So I know I didn't get to see most of the big matches I wanted to see. I don't understand why indies think they need to run 4.5 hours. They don't. Good God. I mean, especially when they're using a bunch of school students on their undercard, they're not good. All right? These kids need to go out and learn. But booking some of these this long, we had one gauntlet match, which had 22, we had an opening tag team gauntlet match, 11 teams, 22 participants, probably went 20 minutes. It was just like, you know, go in and it was just like finishes left and right. Matches just went too long for the skill level they had early on. So I miss a lot of the matches. So the big matches, just because I had to go to work in the morning, and I didn't want to get home at 11:30 at night and have to start work the next day. So promoters out there, try to keep your shows to 3 hours. Make your people much more happier. Than long-ass wrestling shows. Because, one, they'll never be great shows if they're that long, because there's going to be a lot of crap on it. And that's kind of what happened at the beginning. And then some of it was good. There was a fun Ricky Starks, Curt Stallion match. A fun Hooligans tag match. Alley Cat, Christy James, and two other dudes had a good four-way. But by the time the promo was coming around, and I've seen Scott Summers cut promos, so this is going to be like one of these 10-minute promos, and then we had three more matches. It was almost like the time would be getting cut because of the all the undercard running so long. They shouldn't be doing that. I mean, you've been to some of these gauntlet shows, right?
Yeah, some of the they go all night kind of shows.
Yeah, it's just like, why? You just wonder to yourself, why?
I mean, you've never...
Crowd.
The less is more thing, you always hear it from the old timers or the people, right? Less is more, less is more. You never hear anyone make the argument the other way. So I never understand why people try to, like, do something other than that. So, like, you know, just go with it. Everyone says less is more. Go with the less is more.
Yeah. WWF used to run long shows back in the 80s when Crockett was coming to town the next day. So they're trying to burn the crowd out. There was a psychology to it. Here, there's no psychology to it. It's either there's just not structured, you're sloppy, you have no management, time management skills. So please, book these shows shorter. I don't need to be there all fucking day. Unbelievable. You know, and then I have my other, one of my other, local promotions, Russell Circus, is coming back. And they're booking Brian Cage, Tessa Blanchard in the main event. You'd think after a show that kind of canceled the last show and then went on a couple months hiatus, if they're going to be booking this type, again, pretty good talent, you'd think they'd come up with something more intriguing as your main event than Brian Cage versus Tessa Blanchard, wouldn't you think?
You would wish that they could come up with something else, something more people would be interested in. But,
yeah.
Yeah.
I'm frustrated about that. So I'm going to Houston that weekend to support Aero Lucha, and that's going to have Sammy Guevara on it. I think it's going to have Low-Ki on it. It's Conan's booking it. So we'll have, you know, I think we'll have a fun show, and I'll see how that is, and I'll come back with results on that one. But, hey, let's dig right into the show proper. And we open up with a look at CWF Worldwide. And right from the start, we get a shot of William Cross. And he's fighting the All-Stars. Every time Roy Wilkins has that belt, he gets fined $100 a day. So that's, he better give it back. Finally, I complained last week about the logic of having him defending the belt on Worldwide TV and the office does nothing. Well, here it's rectified. They show him a set of balls. Major props for that belt in William Cross's office, because either I believe that's the replica of the real thing, but it looks too clean to be the real thing. But I think that's the replica. Original Mid-Atlantic championship belt that like Ricky Steamboat and Ivan Koloff wore and defended, and Jack Briscoe. Paul Jones, just really, so that's pretty cool. But I like the announcement. I can get behind a fine, and that's what you needed to do. You can't have everybody, you can't take the integrity of the office down. I think this is important, and it gives it feels a lot more like CWF. What do you think of the opening thing segment?
Yeah, love the belt. Also had me drooling over his shoulder there. I thought that was fantastic, super cool. It has to be a replica. I can't believe it's any of the real versions of it. But yeah, that definitely was quite the beaut. And I mean, yeah, it's old school, great stuff, and I liked it, but it feels like everyone kind of does the tongue-in-cheek, and they talk about, you know, or they make jokes, especially I think on Between the Sheets, they like make jokes about like the corny, fine levels of like Jim Cornette. When I say corny, it has a double meaning, you know, Jim Cornette style. Fines where it's like, you know, we're going to fine him, you know, $1,300 or something, and you're like, they're supposed to be big stars, and right now that doesn't sound like very much money, but you have to think about like inflation and the time and it being realistic and everything. So when he says $100 and then he that doesn't sound like much, but it's $100 a day, and I was like, he didn't need to do the part where he points out like that doesn't sound like much, you know, like that felt a little bit too kind of playing off of that smarky take on things. And he could have just said it's $100 a day. And, like, that's a lot of money, and everyone would understand it's a lot of money. So it just felt like a little bit too postmodern, wink, nod. I'm, like, referencing this kind of jokey thing that people talk about old wrestling, how the amounts of money that they find was funny. But other than that, I thought that this was great, and yeah, it's like a great direction for them to go in, really make this stuff make sense, and I love, especially because he sets it up like you're having a mount that you're gonna get charged no matter what, you're gonna get fucked, because he doesn't say like you can just turn the title in whenever. He says it's $100 a day, and oh yeah, you can't turn it into the next show, so you're gonna have to pay for all this time no matter what, and that's kind of great, because it does show that there's a punishment there no matter what. He couldn't just go like, oh, here, take it now, because they're not going to see each other till the show, so he can't turn it in earlier. So I like that as well. That's a little wrinkle that's like a detail that's not quite mentioned, but essentially saying like he's going to have to pay quite a bit of fines for this, which he deserves for doing that, and he's setting up the punishments, and I think that it was a good move all around, honestly.
Yeah, I thought it was a nice piece of business overall. And that leads us into Otto and Mace Lee. Otto Schwantz and Mace Lee versus Nick Richards and McAllister. I thought this is my favorite match on the show. I thought the picture right off the bat looked really crisp. I don't know if you noticed that or not. I don't know what it was. But again, he needs to work on the steady cam action like we were talking about last week. I don't want to beat the same complaint over and over again because I don't like to be a negative show. But yeah, hopefully, I know it takes time, so hopefully they'll grow out of those issues. I love Otto Schwantz. I love Otto doing a kind of Mark Lewin-esque type of gimmick. I really like the Richards and McAllister team. I love Otto. He just has something about him. Solid heat at times. It was a little uninteresting at times, the heat segment. I like the hot tag by McAllister. Love the finish. I really like that finishing move they came up with. But I felt the match went a little long. I think it went at like 12 minutes, which doesn't scream long. But for the heat segment that they did, it wasn't like it was a bad heat segment, but it just wasn't. It got a little uninteresting at times, and maybe they would have been a little shorter. It could have been a little bit more tighter and compact. But overall, I liked the match. I gave it 2, 3, 4 stars, and it was my favorite match of the night. What you make of it, man?
Yeah, I agree with you on being the best match of the night. I also agree with you that it could have been a little bit shorter. This plays into kind of the conversation we had about the matches being a little bit longer, it seems, since the booking kind of changeover. And this is a match that would have been, obviously, I would assume, I can't give, you know, credit where it's not due or it's, you know, can't be proven, but I would have assumed that this match would have been much shorter if it had been booked by Stutzy. And that's not to say
in the 8 to 10 minute range.
Yeah, and that's not to say that it's bad, because I agree with you that it was a pretty good match, all in all. But yeah, I love the tag team. I think Otto's great. I think Mace Lee didn't exist, which is fine. But yeah, with the tag team of McAllister and Richards and then Otto Schwantz, that was a great pairing with all those three guys. So I did enjoy the work and the match itself, but it could have been tightened up. It could have been a lot shorter. But it was still an enjoyable match.
Yep. And then we get a Richards promo, which I thought was a nice wrinkle. And we're going to get McAllister and Richards the promo. And William Cross comes out and explains stuff. And I like the explanation. And I like where they're going where they're going here with the team. And they're gearing up for Crew Noodle Cup. So good for them. What you make of the Richards stuff?
I definitely digged the announcement for the Canoodle Cup. I did find it interesting that they didn't necessarily call it the Canoodle Cup. They just said tag team, and then it'll be happening in, I forget even what month. Did he say May or June? I can't remember. Either way,
June.
Yeah, I'm interested to see. I'm happy that they're building tag teams. There's another tease after this, too, where it feels like they're teasing a tag team for the Canoodle Cup. So yeah, good stuff. I'm excited for the match. Or for the tournament.
Yep. And then we got Dave Dawson versus Snooty Fox. What do you think of this?
This is what I'm talking about. I felt like the ending was teasing the the Snooty Fox and Biggs tag team. It feels a little slapped together because of the missing tag team partner, but it could be an interesting team. I don't know if it's where I would necessarily want to go with Snooty Fox, especially after having a really good match here.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking the same thing. It's like, do you want Biggs to be in a tag team? And I said it last week where I think he should be separated from tag team wrestling, but they gotta answer to the master, and that is they're booking a tag team tournament. And it's bad enough that you're not gonna have Mecha in it. Mecha and Biggs won it last year, so do they have neither one of them in the tournament? Kind of cheapens it a little bit. I mean, and that's not nothing they can do about it. Okay, I'm not. This is not a knock on CWF because it's out of their hands. They're not in business with Mecha Mercenary anymore. So that's crying over spilt milk. So you kind of have to have, you need to fill up the damn tournament. So you need bodies in there. And so you kind of have to. And yeah, it has the possibilities to be an interesting team, but I don't think Biggs should be in a tag team, but you've got to get people in the tournament. You got to get bodies to fill that tournament up, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So I get that. The match here was good. I think it was a good match to show the merit of Snooty Fox. He was able to keep up with Dawson, even though Dawson is pushed and protected pretty well, and he cheats a lot. He's able to pretty much be able to mitigate all of that until the very end. He gets the mule kick, he gets the eye gouging, gets pinned and beaten. Strong heat. I was wondering why it seemed like they were setting up for Snooty to get his heat back as Dawson is even beating him up after the bell, but then that leads into Biggs coming out, obviously teasing that team, and that team will probably be in the Crew Noodle Cup. But yeah, I like the match, but this was another one. I think that it would have been quicker under the past booking regime. It would have probably been faster. It would have served the role maybe a little bit better. And I don't necessarily know if I would have gone with Snooty losing here, personally, if I was going to set it up. But I do think maybe he does need a little bit of setback, and then you can tell the story of why he goes back into the tag team wrestling rather than pushing forward in the singles because of suffering this loss here.
I hope, though, that we get a big heel turn on Snooty in the tournament, and hopefully that'll lead to Biggs and then a Snooty feud, which I can totally get behind. But we'll see where that goes. I enjoyed this match, too. I like Dave Dawson. I thought he was really good working the crowd. I liked the early work with Dawson working the crowd, but it really didn't get going to like the final like 3 minutes. I mean, 3 or 4 minutes, and the match went like 8. I liked Snooty lighting Dawson up with chops. Finally, Dawson gets the arm and he starts to work it over, but then they go kind of go right to the finish. So we didn't even get the steps of actually seeing the body of the really interesting work go down. We got a little like, you know, some fun stuff here, some fun stuff there, but we didn't really get into the meat of the match, and then it got cut off. I'm not saying it needed to go longer. I just think they needed to use their time a little bit more wisely. I was surprised Dave went over on Snooty, but it was a setup for a program. So I kind of get in that direction. I just don't know if it works with the guys' roles there. Maybe if it was Dirty Daddy, I could see losing and then Biggs coming out for the save. You know what I'm saying? Snooty, I don't know. I don't want to see him lose too often because he is kind of a. You don't want to see him hurt his drawing in Chapel Hill and stuff. That leads us to the main event of Eric Royal versus Hurricane Helms. What were you thinking when you saw this?
I mean, I get what they're trying to do. I don't know that I liked it, per se. Love the pre-match stuff with the All-Stars. They're playing kind of, they're really like Abbott Costello, like vaudevillian, Stoogie-type characters. So them kind of playing off everything is always great together. Maybe I would have liked it more if I wasn't spoiled on the surprise of the hurricane. But even then, I don't know that I would be super excited. Maybe I just don't understand the gravity of the CWF legend, the Hurricane Helms, is. I just don't know his history in the company well enough to appreciate just how important it is to have him show up here and have this match. Where
I think he's a fun character.
Right.
But is he a character? I mean, I think Shane Helms could mean something business-wise if they want to go in that direction. I don't think that Hurricane is a guy that means anything in going in that direction. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. No, I definitely agree with that sentiment. I talked about it before with his kind of teasing of the choke slam. I mean, that was a comedy spot in the WWE because of his size, and he's doing it here. And while it's still, he's smaller than Eric Royal, like, girth-wise, he's, you know, pretty tall. And he goes to it over and over again, and it, like I said, it was a comedy spot, so it does kind of make you think of him as a comedy wrestler while he's going against one of the, you know, the best heels in the company and one of the, like, kind of baddest asses in the company. So that definitely doesn't help when he then turns around and beats him, even if you want to argue that maybe it's a little bit fluky or banana peel-ish. Still, not necessarily, I think, a great booking decision for Eric Royal. I agree with you. I think that Hurricane is not someone that makes you look like a big-time company that you put your title belt on Hurricane Helms. I think, like you said, I think Shane Helms, the local legend, who, you know, North Carolina boy who'd done good, is a guy that you could get behind. I mean, fuck, Joey Mercury being used in PWX and SCI, a family of shows, using Joey Mercury, who didn't even have the run that Hurricane had, I think is doing it right with a guy like that who's from the area, who's a known kind of decent wrestler who's done some stuff. Meanwhile, yeah, this feels like every shindy who books the ex-WWE guy and their funny, wacky gimmick. So it really, to me, hurts the legitimacy of CWF overall. Post-match, CWF announces that he's going to defend the title, which, I mean, is obviously a ironclad contract that means that he'll be on every show and will be good for business no matter what, and will always do proper business. So, obviously, that's not just an angle that happened in front of the fans, but a binding contract that we can all believe and trust. So that means it, from going out, Hurricane is 100% full-time and very important to the company, right? I mean, that's what that means.
I don't mind Royal losing the belt because I think Eric Royal, he's like a too good of a worker for the TV belt where I want to see him in less than, I want to see him in matches that go longer than 10 minutes max. So I have no problem with him losing the belt. I mean, yeah, Hurricane winning it was a fun moment for the crowd type of thing. But long term, I don't think it helps the company having a gimmick guy with that. I mean, like somebody like, you know, it just feels like, I think it would have helped some of them so much better if somebody else challenged for the belt and maybe Hurricane interfered in a way and stuff. I haven't watched really a whole lot of Hurricane Helms matches in years since he's probably on WWE TV. So a lot of the spots that he thought were over weren't over in my living room because I didn't understand or didn't remember them. Because, again, I always thought of Hurricane Helms. I always thought he was a good worker. Will never take that away from him. I always enjoyed his gimmick and stuff. But it wasn't like this gimmick that I was always going to remember type of thing. Remember the spots. So they didn't resonate for me in the match. I loved Royal and Coach when it was announced that it was Hurricane Helms. They looked like they saw a ghost and like thought Ric Flair or Jeff Hardy was coming out in the Carolinas, but it's the Hurricane Helms. And he was over, don't get me wrong. But they were putting him over like he's like you know, an elite legend as opposed to a good worker who hit a home run with a nice little gimmick character. And I hate to say it, but that's what the character of Hurricane Helms was. And I've always liked him. I've always liked him as a worker, but he was never a worker that was going to draw you a buttload of money. I thought this was a fun, crowd-pleasing TV match. It just didn't resonate a whole lot for me because, again, I'm not invested in the Hurricane Helms character. I'm way more invested in Eric Royal, who I never wanted to know what the TV belt to begin with. So I'm happy with that result. With that said, I one thing I did like is I liked how they ended with the CWF Strong commercial plugging their next house show in February. I think that's one thing CWF I felt in the old regime failed miserably on, is to do something like this. You know, you have a YouTube channel, you should be promoting your shows. And at least here gives us a couple. We're going to have Trevor Lee, and we're going to have the Hurricane on there. We know what time it is, what the date is, and where you can get tickets. So, and where you can get the shirt. So I thought that was a big time win and a really smart thing to do. What do you think of the final CWF, the plugging of the show?
See, that was a mix for me, and I meant to mention it earlier with the William Cross thing too, because he talked about the dates. I did mention him talking about the date when it came to the fine, but it did feel like, yes, it's a stark difference between the old regime and the new regime, and I bet it was a bit of a sticking point because I felt like the worldwide audience and the come-to-the-show audience were treated like they were vastly different in a way that felt almost kayfabian, I guess you would say, in that it felt like worldwide you were supposed to believe was live to semi-live weekly instead of knowing that it's 4 weeks all taped on the one show that happened that last month. So it's kind of, I guess it's really what you choose. Do you want to have the TV trying to play off the idea that it's live, or do you want to actually plug the events and the merch and the stuff that you talked about on the show? I can't argue with you that it's not better to do business-wise to actually take the time to plug. But I feel that there's just something, I guess, inherently in my mind that you're supposed to do it the other way, but that doesn't necessarily make it correct. It just kind of makes it the WWE style of things that they say you're supposed to kind of try as hard as you can to pretend that it's live. Which has been proven at this point to not necessarily be a big difference maker when it comes to people paying attention. So you're probably better off plugging and trying to make what extra money you can from just putting this stuff out there. So it probably is a smart move, but it is one that for me is a little bit harder to wrap my mind around just because I believe that the other way is correct because of, in some ways, being indoctrinated by the WWE lore of how things are done.
Yeah, fair enough. I thought it was a good, solid thumbs in the middle, thumbs leaning, thumbs up show. Nothing was blow away, but I thought everyone worked hard. And I liked, kind of like some of the angle advancements. Again, I think Big should go solo, but I understand. I mean, it's like, you know, you have to, sometimes you got to book, when you have to fill up a card, sometimes you got to book it so it makes sense, and you got to find him a tag partner. So, and he's needed in the tournament. I mean, it's not like he's not needed in it. So, other than that, what about you? What do you think of the show?
Yeah, thumbs in the middle, leaning up, similar to you. I'm more positive coming out of this than before. It's definitely a different booking philosophy, but I'm willing to let it ride out to see how it goes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they haven't done anything. Yeah, they missed Grant Sawyer a shit ton. They really need to get him back in the fold if they can. But the booking, you know, it's not as tight as what it was. But it's definitely. I mean, I thought it's been pretty solid so far. And they scored many points by using the fine and making logic, giving us a reason why Williams was doing it. I thought I liked the booking choice of McAllister and Richards. I liked the story going forward. I understand the Biggs one. So everything I've seen, I'm enjoying. So keep up the good work and stuff on that aspect. On that note, why don't we take a break, and we'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new. You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And we're back, and we're looking at WXW, Back to Route 17. And this is an interesting show. On paper, I thought it might be better, but it wasn't a bad show. What are your thoughts overall kind of on the show?
That's how the Back to the Roots show is pretty much every year. I think it's a lot of good build. They never deliver super well on the board games style match, I think. This one was quite good, but it wasn't great. It wasn't like that all-timer, like Dangerous Alliance versus Sting Squadron or something, or Four Horsemen versus whatever team Dusty Rhodes puts together. It was solid, but the undercard, I think some stuff lacked. Some stuff was good, some stuff I wasn't necessarily a huge fan of. So yeah, it was like on paper, great show, but I think that this show, I mean, WXW is really smart that they, I mean, when they have a gimmick match like this, a gimmick show, I think that they don't throw away big time matchups on here when they know that the gimmick is what's going to draw, because people do get excited for the War Games match.
Yeah, I agree. They opened it up with Session Moth Martinez versus Melanie Gray. What do you think of this?
I mean, I gave it one star. I didn't much care for it. I think that Martina doing pranks and joking around stuff in a hardcore match kind of ruins it for me. Didn't really get a chance to get into it before it was over. Crowd was into it. I guess it was fun, but it's not for me.
I agree with you 100%. I give it a star also. I'm like, good. I was like, this, what? You know, the beer gimmick is funny, but it gets old, and it's a gimmick. Then we get a Bobby Guns promo, and that was fun. What do you think of it? I mean, it's in a different language.
Yeah, I really liked it. I mean, they're trying to kind of talk about it on the commentary, put it over, and build it up, and I thought that was pretty good, especially the you'd have to live 100 years to fuck as many women as me. That's a great line from Absolute Andy there, so got to give him props on that one. But it was definitely a good way to build up to their match later on the show.
Yeah, then we get a Jern Simmons vs. Dragon match. I thought this was a dud. Even with the post-match kendo stick beatdown, did nothing for me. What about you?
Wow, I liked it. I gave it 2.5 star. So yeah, I didn't think it was great. It was definitely very fast. And I liked Jern Simmons a lot here. Dragon sucks for me. I don't like it. The crowd's into him. But I thought that Jern's new look, new gear, and new attitude was nice. And I liked him throwing Dragon around. But I could definitely see not buying into it if you're not invested in the Jern Simmons heel turn yet. Yeah. Or if you haven't really been paying attention.
Yeah, not hooked.
Yeah, exactly.
Then we got the Mac versus Chris Collins, or Cologne. What'd you make of this?
Cologne, I think, is really good. He's the German Batista character. He does really well with his big power moves. I also think he is really smart with his psychology. He's much bigger than the Mac, so he doesn't ever let the Mac kind of get anything easy on him. He makes him build, or makes him earn it. Colon, with his basic power moves, is always good. The Mac kind of working this new dart or like heel character comes across a little bit too Superman-y for me. Like he's supposed to be some kind of like robot that doesn't sell properly, which sucks because he used to be a really good seller. He needs to learn how to kind of translate his selling into still being a heel, I think, is the next step for him. Gave the match 2 stars. Wasn't super into it at any point, but you know, I think that the Mac is still shaky as a heel for me, and Colon. I think Colon is like a good at best guy who solidly knows his lane and sticks in it, but I think that those two together doesn't really breed a great match, unfortunately.
Yeah, I want 2 stars too. I like Colon using the power moves and stuff, and the Mac gets the shoulder and works it over a bit, but it feels like the narrative wasn't strong enough, and then the story lacked cohesion. It wasn't great or anything. Then we got Bobby Guns versus Absolute Andy, and I like this match a lot. I give it 3 3/4. Brawl start. Love Andy and the fun doing leverage on it. Guns is taking an ass beating. Guns gets the arm. Andy fought the arm work until he couldn't any longer. Guns back on the arm, cut off, back to the arm. I thought the psychology and the story was really tight there. I really dug it. I got into it. I got it 3 3/4. What about you?
I gave it 3.5. I also really enjoyed the psychology. Really enjoyed the big fight kind of Andy playing off being bigger, stronger. He's the veteran. Guns. He's not quite a great baby face yet, but he does a good job of showing a good underneath fire. He's still got a little bit of a heel edge to him, though. He's not pure baby face yet, so I kind of like that his character is going through a transition. He doesn't just flip the switch and turn baby face. I kind of like, that's another thing that WXW I feel does very well, is that they don't bastardize their characters by just letting them completely turn the moment that they're a face. They're just a completely different person. That's far from what happens here. I am a big fan of that. And I liked, again, like I said, I liked the arm work. I liked a lot in this match. I'm excited to see this Absolute Andy heel character. I don't know if I would have went with him getting the win here personally, but I think it also is kind of nice as a stumbling block for Bobby Guns as he kind of works into becoming a babyface.
Yep. What'd you make of Killer Kelly versus Toni Storm?
I liked this a lot. I think I liken it to kind of the shooty hoot matches that people talk about. It's nice seeing the women get a chance to kind of fit that role. Something like the first Riddle versus Speedball Mike Bailey match and beyond, or maybe even comparatively to like Brock versus Goldberg kind of thing. Super quick, has some hard-hitting action. They brawl around a little bit, but they don't really overstay the welcome at all. They hit some great-looking spots. My biggest issue with it was that the finish really felt like it came out of nowhere, and it's kind of a weird thing to say in a match where I talked about it being like a quick hoot-style match, but I really did feel like it was kind of out of nowhere a little bit too much. I could have used a little bit more build to it. Another thing about it, too, is that I wouldn't necessarily have gone with Toni Storm getting the win there when you're kind of telling the story of Killer Kelly being a fluke champion and getting a fluky win. I think that then it undermines her to also have her kind of get just dispatched that way. That said, I really enjoyed the action. I thought both of them looked good, and I gave it 3 stars overall.
I thought it was solid. I gave it 2.25. I thought we got some nice strikes early on. Liked the brawling in the crowd. Just to me, it was just not enough time to take it to a next level. And that leads us to the main event of Ringkampf versus Rise War Games. What do you think, Timothy?
Lots of great action. They really did not waste anything that they could like give away in other places. One thing that they did, though, that I found interesting is that they had Bad Bones start out the match, and they had him start out with Walter, which I thought was a bold move. I think in War Games matches, that would be the matchup a lot of times that you would hope for, but that you would never get as the start of the match. The kind of the two biggest stars from both teams are actually starting the match out together. So that was very interesting for them to do that. And then what are the chances, but the heel team gets the man advantage the whole way through? You'd never expect that, you know what I mean? Like, it just never happens. So they're getting the heat on Walter. Walter's selling there. And then they do the tropes. I mean, it's back and forth. It's every time the heels have the advantage, they're in control. They got the man advantage, they're in control. And then you go to the baby faces, they get the hot comeback. Over, rinse, repeat, obviously, ad finium, ad nauseum. So then from there, you get into the finish. I liked kind of breaking out of the cage, stretching their legs a bit, lots of wanton violence and gore to enjoy, some visceral action there. Continues through into the finish where I thought that they did a good job. You know, Walter chokes him out, gets that submission finish. Not a lot of time teasing, laying around in the hold. He just pretty much chokes him out almost instantly. And it's over. So yeah, I thought that they did a really good job telling the story. They didn't waste anything that they could save for big time shows, but they had some great action. They played with the gimmick really well. No one had to overwork or kill themselves. They milked the drama out of the gimmick, which is the best way to do it. Really, like I said, I think that the WXW War Games matches, they don't deliver on the high level, but they always deliver pretty solidly. 3.5 stars, good stuff, fun action all around, and I hope that it kind of builds into more storyline stuff going forward. Obviously, get that big Walter versus the champion. This is another kind of me and my buddy group have been teasing, is that Bad Bones is defending the title against Speedball. This is the third time Speedball is getting a WXW title shot. I think it's the second time he's getting a title shot from Bad Bones. It's very interesting because it doesn't fit the booking of WXW to be giving him a title shot like that, kind of out of nowhere. So we're all kind of assuming that he might win the title. He's got a rematch with Bad Bones on the last night of the We Love Wrestling tour, which is also interesting because why would he be getting a rematch for the title again unless it's a rematch to give Bad Bones a shot at getting the title off of him? And then they announce that there is on the second night of 16 Karat, it's going to be Walter versus the champion, and they're putting out the graphic showing both Bad Bones and Speedball, putting over the narrative that there's a possibility that Walter does take on Bad Bones for the title, having gotten this submission on him. But it feels almost like that's so kind of predictable that maybe they're going to switch it up, and then that match is going to be Walter versus Speedball in Night 2 of Karat. You have Speedball play the transitional champion between Bad Bones to Walter to then play into David Starr winning 16 Karat, and you have David Starr versus Walter for the title as the next big match. That feels possible. It all feels likely. It also could be none of that. It could just be Bad Bones versus Walter. Bad Bones still wins, and who knows who wins Karat. But it's definitely interesting booking, and it's definitely, this is a good pit stop on that story, because as I said, the finish does play into that booking, because Walter got the submission on Bad Bones, so he earned a title shot. But is he necessarily going to get that title shot from Bad Bones? I guess we'll find out. So it's all very exciting, and it just, again, goes to show how well the WXW is booked, where all of this stuff means something, it's important, and it gives you stuff to look forward to.
Yeah, I'm with you. I enjoyed it. I'm with you. I gave it 3.5 stars. Anytime you get to see Walter in like in a cage, it feels special. And then we've got a big Haas battle, big move strikes, good storytelling. Totally dug it. And I thought overall they did a good job here. And I thought it was a good, solid thumbs up show. What about you, man?
Yeah, easy thumbs up show. If you're a fan of WXW, this is a very watchable show. It's not the show that I'm showing to my grandma to get her into WXW, though. You know what I mean? This is a show for the fan. It's not necessarily that first get excited about WXW show, but still very good and very watchable if you know the characters and if you want to watch them kind of in this cool setting.
Cool. On that note, well, that's it for this week. We have one more segment, and we'll be having Devin Hales joining us for some NXT action. And we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And we're back, man. And not only are we back, but we're back with a special guest. We have Devin Hales joining us to discuss the NXT special. Devin, man, how you doing, friend?
I'm doing great. Just moved about an hour and a half northeast from Chattanooga to Knoxville, Tennessee. So I am now currently residing in Smoky Mountain Wrestling Country now.
Nice.
I moved in with another Hales brother, Dustin, who's been living in Knoxville the last several months. So I jumped on the Knoxville train, I guess, so to speak, and just finally getting moved in and coming off a big wrestling weekend.
Oh, hell yeah, man. It was a wild card, really buzzworthy. I mean, we'll get into the details, of course. The Gargano, Cien Almas match, I mean, people talking about it. Possibly being the best WWE match of all time, or in that breath, definitely up there for NXT matches. You want to question the booking a little bit here and there? Did they go for did they try to keep it like? Did they intentionally go with that finish that we got to try to maximize star ratings, as opposed to going for what the natural business decision would have been? Which would have been Ciampa interfering at the finish. And we'll get all into that, but I think that's a little bit more, I think that's pretty interesting too on how they did it. Instead of doing a traditional finish to maximize business and stuff, but we'll get right into this show. And ask you first, Timothy, we got Undisputed versus the Authors of Pain. What were your thoughts on this match, man?
I really enjoyed it. I hear a lot of people talking about best that the Undisputed Era Red Dragon has looked in NXT. I feel like that's becoming kind of the go-to every time that they come out. So I think people are starting to just appreciate them more. They may be getting a little bit more comfortable in their skin. It seems that way. You know, from the first thing, obviously, Kyle O'Reilly coming out playing the title belt. I've heard a lot of people kind of saying how cool that is. He's playing air guitar on the title belt and this and that. For me, it's just one more thing that feels like NWO, Hollywood, Hulk Hogan knockoff bullshit for this act that doesn't work for me. And I've been like the biggest Kyle O'Reilly apologist for years. And I'm like, man, that's fucking lame. Like, you look like an idiot. Knock it off. And other people are just all in love with this.
Really funny, Timothy, is Johnny Sorrow hated Red Dragon in Ring of Honor, right? But he absolutely loves the act in NXT.
It's perfect.
It's kind of like the opposite.
Yeah, it's this amazing switch that me and him are having, I guess, that, you know, I just, I'm not as into him here.
Clearly in the minority when it comes to Red Dragon and NXT.
Right, I mean, people are liking them in NXT, that's for sure. Great legwork from Undisputed Era, obviously. Really liked that and played into the narrative for the finish, so that's even better when you get some kind of payoff from that. One talking point I'm seeing or hearing over and over again is this comparison to Red Dragon and Revival, and people, I think it's just because so many people who are WWE centric, this is their, that's their exposure to good tag team wrestling, without the concept that like there can be just a lot of teams who are good tag teams who work a limb and do kind of that style. But I mean, to me, Revival and Red Dragon, the only similarity would be like that they do limb work and that they're a tag team that works as a team. But people are making this comparison, and I'm not even trying to say that I argue with the point that a lot of people make, which is that Revival's better, because I will openly say like Revival is a better team than Red Dragon to me, especially in a WWE setting. But like comparing them just kind of shows your lack of like knowledge of tag team wrestling throughout the years, because like it's really a surface level thing. If you have any exposure to the history of tag team wrestling, you're just like, they're two teams who are proficient at tag team wrestling. That's why you're thinking that they're similar, but like there's been plenty of teams that are exactly just as proficient, and they all have their own little unique kind of niches that they fill. So I just don't see that at all, and I see that talking point coming up everywhere, and it's just a weird...
Yeah, and I'm going to interrupt you right now because I want to hit on this talking point. I agree. I think the Revival are better in the WWE setting when it comes to that type of thing. But I still think Red Dragon is a better team because I feel like they could work a cruiserweight style. They could work a New Japan Junior style. They can work Japan-centric. They could actually, if UWFI was still around, they could probably work UWFI style. So I think Red Dragon has more versatility in a way. And then to compare the two, it's kind of, I mean, I understand it because in the WWE model, they do use a lot of the same psychology, cutting off the ring, working an arm, working a leg. They do stooge spots. I think Red Dragon's more MMA-centric. But I think when it comes to versatility, and I think Bobby Fish is still a better promo than there were all four of them. But I think Red Dragon is a little bit more versatile than them. Devin, where are you landing in on the Revival versus the Red Dragon when it comes to like versatility and when it comes to things?
I really haven't watched like the Red Dragon era of Ring of Honor. Like the Ring of Honor I've seen is like, you know, like classic era Ring of Honor, like 02 to 08. And then like, you know, the like two Ring of Honor shows I've been to live in the last 3 years. So, you know, my knowledge of Red Dragon isn't that high outside of their WWE performances. And they definitely, I mean, and I pretty much agree with Tim in that they're really not the same kind of tag team as the Revival are. And I actually agree with you too, Pete, that they're definitely, at least, you know, they seem like they're a little bit more versatile in terms of what they can do. And I think you brought up a good point in that they're much more MMA based and UWFI style, because if I can go ahead and start talking about the match a little bit, that's what it kind of felt like to me. It kind of felt like almost like a weird quasi shoot style like match at times with Kyle O'Reilly doing the jujitsu and stuff like that. So it and I did like this match a good bit. it almost struck me as odd and weird a little bit, because there was these two smaller guys sort of kind of almost out wrestling and taking on these bigger guys with kind of this MMA shoot style like work, and it took me off a little bit because I wasn't expecting it. But then again, like I said, I'm not used to Red Dragon, so I haven't really seen them pull out that type of wrestling before. So I was a little bit taken aback. So the match felt almost weird because it was just the shoot style stuff, the ground and pound and stuff that they were doing. I just wasn't expecting it out of the match. I thought it was very good.
For me, I had the same thing, and I think a lot of people did. And for me, while I am familiar with Red Dragon, I mean, we reviewed a bunch of Red Dragon matches. I've been following them since they started, you know. But to me, I was even somewhat taken aback, too, because in this setting, as heels, like pure heels, I've really never seen them wrestling a bigger team. Like, predominantly, if they are wrestling a team that's bigger than them, like you would say, like maybe War Machine or something, they're usually more tweeners at the worst and probably baby faces or leaning baby faces. So it was a different thing for them. But I would say that the biggest kind of the proof is in the pudding, and that the match worked and that the crowd didn't switch sides. The crowd reacted to AOP as big time baby faces, and they did not like the finish with the heels getting the win. So, I mean, even if I was, I think, taken aback as well as you were, I think that the argument pro is, like, even if me and you were taken aback, the people in the crowd knew exactly what they were supposed to be rooting for and who they were supposed to get behind. So I, you know, it worked.
Oh, absolutely. And I think you have to praise Authors of Pain some too for that, because it showed that they can also work babyface very well, because the crowd stuck with them, and it showed that they believe it or not, these big guys are pretty good at selling and working in peril too. So I just think they flipped the script a little bit, because, you know, typically when you see those two teams of those sizes, and, you know, Authors of Pain have just turned face sort of just kind of organically in the last couple of months since Undisputed Era came in and War Games and whatnot. But it was kind of an interesting little twist, because it's, you know, the two bigger guys playing the baby faces, and these two smaller guys are using their kind of quasi shoot style smart heel tactics to kind of take the advantage. So it was a unique match for sure, and I liked it a good bit, and I really liked the finish with the collapse of the knee after the what do they call the power bomb, the super destroyer, whatever,
super collider.
Call it. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
I thought the finish was well done as well. So yeah, I really liked this match a good bit.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when you were talking about that point, Timothy, of comparing them. I always felt like the Revival were the Anderson brothers, while Fish and O'Reilly were more like Tully and Arn in that sense, where they're doing some more. They use their more traditional. Seem like they use that formula more along with the MMA stuff. But I really liked this. We started off with some fun brawling, and then the Authors of Pain flexes their muscles and shrugs it off, and we see some fun stooging, I felt, from the Undisputed Era. I can see where some people would be taking it back, where they're doing this shoot style, and then all of a sudden they're stooging and putting over the Authors of Pain in some comedy spots and stuff. But it actually worked for me, and I thought they meshed it really well. I loved Akeem. Which one is it? Razor and what?
Akeem.
Or Akeem.
Okay. I like him, how he's dings that leg, and then Fish starts destroying it, and then we see some in and out, and they're both destroying the leg, and props to Akeem selling. I thought he did a fantastic job here. The Dragon Screw leads to this really like hot tag. Fish, he did something that led up to this hot tag that I screw up that I didn't really buy into. I really didn't like this part of it, but it didn't ruin the match for me. Razor's hot tag was great, and then he's the numbers game catches up to Razor. And we get this really strong finishing stretch. I mean, I thought it was like a really strong opener, 3 3/4. I thought they meshed all the styles well together. I don't know where you go with Authors of Pain from here. It kind of feels like their run's really peaked here.
Time to move them up after the latest, yep, I think.
Exactly. You know, got to freshen up that roster. I mean, that's kind of what NXT's now become. I mean, we always knew it was the feeder system, but it really now it's become apparent, especially with the women's division.
It's getting overloaded. And we may need to talk about that because they have got way too many people on that NXT roster, and they have got to start moving people up because it's getting a little ridiculous.
This happens from time to time, though. I mean, I can remember at least a half dozen times where it's felt exactly like this, that there's just too many people, there's not enough room, people are being stifled. And then it usually gets cleared out in some way, or people get switched around in a way, and it usually goes right back to... It really ebbs and flows. It's interesting the way that NXT works. I mean, they've always got, obviously, an abundance of people there, but it's only, like, a handful who are really worthwhile to be on the TV.
Sure.
But, I mean, I have felt like there's peaks and there's valleys. I felt like there's times where you feel like there's, like, two people on the fucking entire roster that are worth a damn, you know? Like, it's been at that time. But right now,
they already introduced Ricochet and War Machine on the TV, EC3, but we haven't gotten a sniff of Donovan Dijak, have we?
No, which is terrible.
Dijak hasn't been on TV, and you know Lio Rush has been on TV 3 times. That's partly because he's an idiot, but
yeah,
right. Well, and I feel like Dijak is one of the more polished guys that they have. I mean, for what they're looking for.
He's such a unique wrestler because he's a big guy who can do crazy high spots. So, you know, you'd think they'd put him on TV, but...
I mean, for what they're looking for NXT, I'd feel like Dijak honestly fits in better than Ricochet does, like, just right off the bat. So it's weird that they put Ricochet on TV first, to me.
Yeah, and then you've got guys like Buddy Murphy, who was on TV for 2 years straight, and then they take him off 2 years, you know, take him off, and all he's doing is working, you know, the fucking Florida loop and the house shows, and that's it. You know, he's not even on TV.
Yeah, and he's still secretly one of the, like, probably best workers that they actually have.
Yes.
And no one realizes how good he actually is.
I mean, I thought his tag team was really good, too, you know?
Where
you could work with some of these guys. Maybe if they don't see money in that team, but, you know, they could work. At least let them work with some of these up-and-coming teams that they... think of a future on the roster or what have you.
Yeah,
it's weird.
That leads us into the next match. We have the coach, Cassius Ohno, versus the Velveteen Dream. What were you thinking here, Devin?
The first minute was outstanding. Velveteen Dream's entrance was phenomenal. I love that he's sort of changing up his entrance every big match. I think he's really got the character down pat, the facial expressions, the reactions, the mannerisms. His promos are unique. He's got everything down as a character, and the mouthpiece, and the boxing shorts, and the whole deal where he was going to knock out Ohno in 30 seconds, and then the fans started counting down right at the bell. And then he actually does get the knockout.
Hot for that, you know. It really made it special.
Oh yeah, and they played that up huge, and he actually gets the knockout. And then Ohno gets back up and just blasts him. Looks like 2015, 2016 Chris Hero, like killing Zack Sabre Jr. with the level of strikes he was hitting there. And then I think after that, the match just sort of came to a halt. I think Dream got exposed a little bit and showed his. That he's still got some work to do, mostly due to sloppiness. I think he got a little bit lost there on offense. I think he kind of stuck to the chin lock a little bit too much. But the big transitions and big spots down the stretch were a little scary at times. He couldn't get Hero up for the big Death Valley driver. I think they actually may have adjusted and. Might have called an adjustment after that, and they may have went a little bit longer to get to that spot, because I think he ended up hitting the DVD at the end to win the match. But Yeah, it was a solid match with a great opening minute. But I think it showed that Dream has some work to do on his timing, and on working on those big spots and transitions. And this is a situation where, you know, Dream is a little bit smaller than Hiro is, or I keep going. I feel like a Mark who gets mad about the name changes. I think that weight difference might have been an issue there. The match was solid. I think it kind of came to a halt a little bit. It was never bad. It just kind of, you know, just kind of went from great to decent. I think as far as Dream overall, I think he's got the character and the promo and the mannerisms down. I just think he has to polish his in-ring work up a little bit.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you're saying that. He does definitely need, after seeing this match, he definitely needs a polish. But, I mean, he was really coming off strong after the Aleister Black match. And then I thought he had that great match with Gargano, right?
Yep.
And I you really thought, oh, man, this guy's really turned the tide. But then he comes in with a great worker in Hiro Ono. And he has, a, you know, like you said, a really strong first minute. But he clearly needs polish, needs some work on the timing. I would love to see these guys run this thing back with just a boxing gimmick. I would love to see this in this match. I think it would be fun. But yeah, you're right. It was after the first couple minutes, it kind of lost its way. There were some hiccups here and there. It wasn't a bad match or anything.
No.
But it definitely. I felt it fell on Dream's fault on timing and just being able to fill the time type of thing. It just feels like a real kind of like, you know, like you people probably felt he was really turning the tide, like he was the next guy. And Tim, you might have even said that, I think, on the show a little recently, that, man, Dream's really ready. And then he comes back with this performance, which was not a bad performance, but it was not the star-making performance that you just had. So on that note, Timothy, what were you thinking when you saw this?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of basing it off the Gargano, the setup, and then the match, and then, you know, he kind of had a similar thing here, where the pre-match and the setup and leading into it was telling me the story that, yeah, he's ready for the main roster. He's the next big guy there. I think what I did say actually last week as well is that they should just have him, like, essentially be working a lot more, because that's the part that's possibly missing. Like, just keeping him off even the NXT TV. And, like, even though that seems stupid, it's almost kind of good, like, similar to Braun and stuff. So he can pop up on the main roster and just be an instant revelation, even to the people who pay attention to NXT on the main roster, as a fully formed character and all that. But yeah, there's something in the work here. I think, you know, it's a totally different animal from wrestling Gargano and, you know, Aleister Black, then when you come in here and you're wrestling, you know, I'll say a wife beater so that I can one-up Devin on the smarkiness of X names. I thought that, you know, throughout the whole match, anything that had to do with transitions or timing from the old wife beater Chris Hero here, he was perfect. He was spot on. But Cassius Ohno couldn't make the entire match perfect, and I think that Dream couldn't. He wasn't necessarily used to working with a guy that size. I mean, it's an anomaly in wrestling nowadays for a guy to be as big as Chris Hero is. I mean, they did, I don't know if you saw, but the big, like, introspective reflection piece on Chris Hero's career that they put.
I did.
Yeah, and they're pushing his, you know, his nimbleness on his feet, but they mention it, you know, for a guy his size. I think you really need to take a second time when you mention that. You need to really stress how fucking big he is, especially now. Compared to wrestlers now, he's a fucking giant.
Hero's an 80s throwback. I mean, that's what he is, size-wise, you know?
Yeah, and, I mean, so yes, he can do a lot of this stuff, and yes, he bites off a little bit more than he can chew. When it's just him, he never really has any issues. If it's stuff that he's doing, but when he has to count on somebody else to base for his big ass, it usually doesn't always work out.
yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it got a little sloppy in the middle, but I felt that the match never felt like it fell apart. I can definitely see what you're saying, because there was times where it felt like Dream was really a little bit too dominant and almost like he was swamping Ohno, and I think that's where Dream starts to fall off, because he doesn't have a lot of offense and a lot of stuff to kind of go into. And even Chris Hero talked about this as something that he learned in NXT after he first got fired, is that he used to want to go, 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 move, 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 hold, everything, and he dropped a lot of that, and you could see it towards the end of his indie run. You know, he wasn't always going to a hold. He would milk the control spots with the guy on the ground, on the mat. He would kind of milk looking for a big shot, a big kick, a big senton here and there. And that's kind of what turned him into this big kind of awesome worker, is that he had this kind of cat-like stalking quality where he's always picking his little spots here and there. And that's what I think Dream is still really lacking. So it's hopefully something he can learn pretty quickly here, is how what to do in those in-between spots, because it's like they say with music, right? It's the silence between the notes, and, you know, that's what he's missing right now. So I gave the match 3 stars. I really enjoyed it, but, yeah, it didn't make Dream look like a can't-miss top guy, should be the champion yet.
Yeah, I went 2 3/4, but I would say Dream did look like a star that first minute of the match. It just fell apart a little bit. Another major, just kind of... I even thought the match might have gone a little too long for where they were going with it and stuff. But then, man, we get Shayna Baszler versus Ember Moon. I know you're a big fan of Baszler, Tim. What were you thinking when this match was booked and how it played out? And are you a little surprised they were going pushing Baszler here now that they have Ronda on the roster, who you're assuming is going to be working a very similar style?
I mean, assuming, again,
wouldn't this, like, obviously you're going to, if Ronda doesn't meet, pass the muster test, aren't they going to compare, don't you think people are going to directly compare to Baszler immediately now?
Yeah, and it's going to be difficult, because that's an uphill battle for Ronda. I was having this conversation with the usual suspects, I don't have to even say their names at this point, about the difference between Ronda and Shayna, and to me, Ronda, she came out, and I know that she's a star. I've experienced both of them live just there. I've seen Shayna perform. I've seen them both just in a round. And Shayna always comes across like a big-time star. She is believable in her character. And Ronda, when she came out at the Rumble, I didn't buy into her at all. And she didn't have star quality to me. She's out there wearing her dad's jacket. It makes her look like she's just a little girl. I understand the kind of symbolism. Yeah, I know. I get the symbolism. But, like, to me, it doesn't help to make you look like a star. It really doesn't, wearing an oversized leather jacket, even if it is kind of cool that it plays back to Roddy Piper.
My favorite part was when she comes out was that... Because I hate the fact that they point to the stupid WrestleMania.
That's the best part. It was hilarious.
Yeah, and she just looked so unconvincing when she was doing it. Where I think you really got to have that sports entertainment mentality to pull off pointing to the fucking Mania sign and make it work, honestly. I mean, people were overly critiquing her pointing at it, but it looked so eye-rollingly bad, I will say that.
So. Well, yeah. Well, the one thing about her debut, or I guess slash return since Mania 31, but you know whatever.
Right.
She was marking out like visibly, so she was just laughing the entire time.
Yeah.
So like I always thought it was a fair criticism that my brother Dylan made about Daniel Bryan when he was a babyface. He would always, like, laugh during a serious promo sometimes. He would crack up, and, like, so, like, he would, like, kind of mess up his serious promo sometimes. And, like, Ronda kind of has the same issue with, like, she was – I mean, this could change if, you know, once she's around long enough. But she was totally marking out and, like, grinning from ear to ear and, like
–
Yeah, I mean, like, which is fine. But, like, at the same time, it was a little odd. It might have hurt her star power a little bit.
Well, what will help is that she's working in WWE and not, like, on the indies like Bryan Danielson was. So, really quickly, she'll stop having fun.
she immediately tries to get into the mean Ronda look when she walks down the aisle, but she can't even keep that long enough. And she's just high-fiving people, and I mean, she's just having a blast, and I don't blame her. She's happy for the time being right now. He probably got a sweet ass contract. I think this is a win-win situation.
Oh, for sure.
You know, this girl has a lot of eyeballs on the product. If you work with her, she's a. I think she, you know, I think she'll get it eventually. Because I guarantee you they're not going to have her lose too often right off the bat. So I think it'd be interesting. But the fact that they're doing Shayna Baszler right now is a rough. It's going to be tough because you don't know how Ronda right off the bat will be in comparison. Because
let me interject real quick. Let me interject real quick, and I know we're kind of going off the rails a little bit about the Ember Shayna match, but Sonya Deville might be in trouble because she's got the MMA gimmick, and there's Shayna, and then there's Ronda.
Yeah. Deville's like the C. She's in WWE land. She's the main event of and Shayna and Ronda are the Raw and SmackDown.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah. Yeah, part of my point also is just that the backgrounds, I think that people assume that, you know, MMA background is all the same, but if you look at the background and the actual logistics of the training comparatively, I mean, Baszler's going to have an easier transition with her background in the snake pit being trained by Billy Robinson, catch wrestling that translates instantly into professional wrestling. I mean, you know, Billy Robinson was a pro wrestler, you know, catch wrestler style, you know, one of the kind of archetypes of the strong style in Japan and everything. And, I mean, what you could call the catch wrestling, pro wrestling background for Shayna would be, like, Jean LaBelle. And, I mean, I don't think that Billy Robinson and Jean LaBelle are super comparable when it comes to talents for professional wrestling and proficiency of kind of transitioning their styles into professional wrestling. So, to me, I think that you just look at that and it shows why Shayna is going to, like, be, I think, a little bit more naturally proficient in the pro wrestling landscape.
And she's a natural fan, too, right?
Right. I mean, she's a hardcore wrestling fan. That was why she, you know, part of why she trained the catch wrestling with Billy Robinson and Josh Barnett. And, you know, so, I mean, yeah, it's going to be a big part of it. She carries herself like a star.
And trained with a lot of the girls from the roster. So, I mean, there's that natural, you know, camaraderie right off the bat while Ronda is kind of like the outsider. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure, you know, you saw the girls already working on Twitter, which I'm sure is straight shooting.
That's all a fucking work. People are like,
work. But
yeah,
I think
I know, but I've heard, like, I always hate, like, I mean, you know, rumors are rumors, but, you know, I go on the cage side seats, rumor roundup, and they're like, well, that was all a shoot. And I was like, nah, fuck off.
Yeah, even, Keller was trying to say, like, it's a work, but it's based on a shoot, is what they said. He said that they were told to do it, but they all felt that way anyways. And it's like, oh, okay, sure, yeah. Yeah, you're not being worked.
Yeah, I don't think anyone was dumb enough to really challenge Ronda Rousey in real life and piss her off. So, I mean, I meant a straight shoot as in it's, like, bullshit. It's, I mean, it's...
They're just like Aubrey Sitterson's show, right?
The fact that the Bellas are cutting promos on Twitter, they're angling for a fucking match. I mean, that's just like...
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they are.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of the Bellas, I believe Shayna Baszler taught Nikki Bella one of her submission moves.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. But yeah, so this match was great. I loved Shayna murdering the arm. I've heard some kind of takedowns on the straight armbar lasting too long. My favorite was Dave Meltzer's kind of excuse for it, that it just was too long. She was in a straight armbar for too long, and everyone knows that that'll kill you. And then Alvarez turns around and kind of says to him, well, you love Tanahashi versus Minoru Suzuki, and he's got a heel hook on her, which is illegal in the UFC because it's a more dangerous move. And, you know, Suzuki's won 38 MMA fights compared to Shayna, and all of these reasons why that makes way less sense than this situation. But, you know, that's fine. And, you know, Meltzer's kind of logic is, well, Tanahashi's a big star, so it's fine. It's just like, what the fuck are you talking about? If it's fine, it's fine. And when it works, it works. And I thought it was fine in here. I thought that she fought They didn't make it seem like her arm should have been broken and all this, and they played off of it. I thought the finish was good. I enjoyed the match. I gave it 3.5 stars. I don't think it's the best fucking match in the history of the world, but I thought it was good, and I don't think that that spot deserved any ridicule. If you're going to say that that spot deserves ridicule, then they should just never use arm bars in pro wrestling because they're not believable in a pro wrestling setting.
There you go.
It could work, anyway. I find Meltzer's critique of that, yeah, because Suzuki's fucking heel hook lasted at least five times as long as the Shawn Michaels turn angle ankle lock spot that everyone still rags on in that match at WrestleMania. They ashamed of themselves. What did you think of this, Devin, the Baszler and Ember Moon match?
I thought it was really good, and another reason why the armbar finish that lasted a while was so great was there was great heat to it. It reminded me of, you know, it wasn't worked exactly like that, but it reminded me of like those UWFI or like rings matches where, you know, these people are like trying to get a fucking hold on for like 5 minutes and people are like desperately trying to fight out. And there's like this great atmosphere and aura and heat to it. And that's what it really felt like. And people really got behind Ember, who I thought was fantastic working from underneath. And as far as Shayna applying the armbar, she never really fully applied it except for like maybe 5 to 10, you know, except for like maybe like, I don't know, 3 seconds at a time tops. Like Ember was always fighting out, rolling out, finding ways to get out of it, always locking her arms together to break it. So it wasn't like she was like, it wasn't like she had her in the armbar and they just sat there for, you know, 5 fucking minutes. I mean, there was an actual fight and struggle over the armbar, and I thought the finish was really well done. It was a good way to give Ember a longer reign, who worked her ass off to get to to get the NXT title, and then never got to beat Asuka, which I think in a lot of ways actually hurt Ember. But I think her performances in the ring have been good enough to where the fans are starting to get behind her. I thought she was actually really good in the Rumble match when she came in on Sunday.
I was big in the Rumble match, too.
Yeah, she was. Took some crazy, crazy bumps in that match, too. She was really good in this, and Shayna has the aura and badass character down to a pat. And I love the post-match, too. You know, it keeps Shayna strong, but also keeps the belt on Ember and lets this feud move forward.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we don't need to rush out of it. It adds heat to it. It adds another layer to it. I totally. This is total basic. This is MMA versus pro wrestling angle, and they did it really well. I thought here. I liked Shayna's like entrance was like Goldberg light, where you know she's punching and kicking, but she doesn't get the pyro or the security guards and stuff.
Yeah.
I liked how Baszler uses the MMA style, but with a heel's twist to it. Like, she does it, but does it, like, not just viciously, but does it with a gleam in her eye. Like, she's, like taking over the world type of thing. Like, Dr. Evil. And I appreciate that. You got to give Moon great credit, because, I mean, she could have made a farce out of this, but her selling was what made Baszler so believable on that armbar destruction. And he got a lot of heat. To me, it was effective, and it worked. So, for people who thought it went too long, I mean, if the crowd died and sat on their hands during it, then it went too long. The crowd was with it. So, I think the proof is in the audio there. And I give it 3.5 stars. I liked it, and I loved the post-match, and I'm more for these girls sticking to it. And it was interesting, because I thought Ember got one of her best reactions at the Rumble. I thought Kairi Sane came across so much better and bigger at the Royal Rumble than she has on NXT. Devin, what do you think about Sane in the Rumble? Did she come across as a bigger star there,
too?
Oh,
yeah. She got a great pop, got to shine a ton. She was like someone who got to shine more than a lot of people on the main roster, other than the handful of the bigger stars. Yeah, exactly. I mean, she got to hit the elbow twice. Stephanie was marking out for it. She got a nice little push in the Rumble match and was very well received and very good in it.
My one issue with her in the Rumble and in, you know, the WWE so far in general has just been that she doesn't have the same, I guess, stiffness with the girls here. And I think that comes with just not being familiar with them. But we'll see how it goes. But it's
you
definitely
know
missing.
I felt the same thing with Asuka when she first came in. Because, you know, I think Asuka is stiffer with certain girls than she is with others in matches. If you just watch kind of her history of the WWE the last few years. But, like, she, like, there are times where Asuka, like, works awfully light. And it's, like, it kind of surprises me. Because if you watch, you know, like, a fucking Kana match, she's ripping people's heads off, you know, and kicking the crap out of people. And it's like, so, you know, that's definitely something that I think that they have to learn to transition into and to change a little bit.
Yeah, and I think that they're stereotypically told that, I think. It's that a lot of, I mean, it's just the thing. Like, the Japanese are told that Americans work super soft. So I think that if they come over, they just have that idea that that's what they expect. I mean, it kind of mind-fucked Kenta, obviously. It really affected his career. That he had an expectation that he couldn't work stiff at all in America. So, I don't know. But, yeah, that was the only thing that I noticed in her run in the Rumble. I was like, she's looked great, but I'm just like, God, these strikes would just look a little bit better if she was in there, you know, with girls that she knew really well. Because you could just tell she was holding back a little bit.
It just seems she seemed more over, though, at the Rumble than she did in their title run just a couple months ago.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Big time. And her charisma stood out at the Rumble. That leads us to Adam Cole, Aleister Black, the no DQ match. What were you thinking here, Devin?
This match had the most heat from beginning to end in the entire show up to this point. You know, I'm not an Adam Cole fan really at all, but he's very over, and he comes across like a star because he's over enough to kind of become a star because the fans really love him. And I mean, I can't get into him, but I also, you know, do have to praise him some for his performance. He took some Joey Janela like bumps in this with the crazy ladder bump off the electric chair, which was nuts. No pun intended. He took the Joey Janela chair bump in this match, which was also pretty insane. And I think didn't Black give him like the double stomp through the fucking table on the outside too? Like, wasn't that a spot that happened in this match?
Yeah, and when it was setting it up, Black, I was like, "There's no way this is gonna work."
Yeah, Black took the Mick Foley nasty plunge from the top rope through the table.
It was a total. I mean, this was, you know, there was a lot of, you know, or like inorganic spot setups, and there was some, you know, the interference was predictable, but I mean, it had good heat, but it was kind of, you know, it was predictable and whatever. And I didn't love this match, but it was certainly a fun match, and it got over really well, and there were some pretty lunatic bumps from both guys in the match, and I think both guys worked pretty hard. And I also think the right guy won too. I think it was right to have Black win the match as well.
What about you, Tim? What were you feeling on this?
Very similar. I've talked about it before with Adam Cole when it comes to these gimmick matches. I think that's where he's best because he really milks the gimmicks and makes the most out of them. But even here,
he's really like Edge. Sorry to interrupt, but he reminds me of Edge. You know, Edge wasn't my favorite wrestler by any means, but he could work. You know, he wasn't a great wrestler in straight matches, but he could really milk those gimmick matches. And I think Adam Cole's very similar.
Yeah, he gets the most out of everything, and he makes the setups. But he, like I said, even here, it was more sports entertaining than it used to be. But that's fine, because it just shows his adaptability. And he's a guy that while I'm kind of with Devin in that I was a big fan of his for a long time and feel that I think he's just one of these guys who just got it so fast that he's like almost comes across like he's in first or second gear. Because he doesn't need to go up into fourth gear to do what he needs to accomplish with the crowd. And it just comes across sometimes for people like us who are like really parsing the work rate and everything out where we're like, ah, fuck this, you know, this fat, lazy slob. But like, realistically, he's like kind of a prodigy of wrestling. Because you talked about comparing him to Janela, but you forget that the Panama City Playboy was in CZW. He was the original Joey Janela. You know what I mean? Like, he was a very similar character in CZW years ago. So comparing him that way, I mean, it's kind of funny to think, like, it's come full circle like that. That said, I thought that Black, I mean, weirdly, I think Black felt like almost an afterthought in here, even though he was very game. The double knees through the table was super impressive, or the double stomp, double knees, whatever it was, because I saw that, and I was like, these tables don't break for Randy frickin' Orton. They're not going to break for you, dude. But he threw himself into that shit so hard that it just smashed everywhere. I thought that the interference was, yes, super predictable. You even almost, you knew that Sanity was coming out, you know, even though they're not supposed to be related to Black in any way. You just kind of expected that. That said, I mean, there's brutal stuff. There's a good mix of violence with goofiness. But, like, you know, I think one of the main things that really shows the, like, kind of milking the gimmicks and kind of being sports entertainment is the chairs. I mean, when he puts the chairs out and then he turns around and turns them so they're back to back, but then he takes that brutal ass spot. It's kind of, it's hokey, it's a little bit cartoony, it's over the top, but then you kind of pay it off with some just wanton violence, and it kind of makes it all worth it. That said, after all is done, I gave it 3.25 star. Really enjoyed it, but it's hard for me to super sink my teeth into it. Like I said, I thought that Black, it was important. It was good that he got the win because he didn't come across super great in the match to show off his skills. He was good in there that you saw that he was adaptable and that he was game for being in the match, but it really felt like it was a showcase match for Cole that he was kind of, you know, in. He was there for every spot, but he wasn't necessarily driving the action. But I did enjoy the match quite a bit.
At this point in my life, Tom, I am numb to matches like this. It's just eye-rolling to me, and I can't get into them. And this is no different. Yeah, there's some interesting spots here and there. And I will say, live, these things are always fun. Even though I'm not into them, you always get into them because of the big whacking noises and all that stuff. So, I mean, live, I'm sure it worked. For me, it's just like, you know, great, okay, chair shot, sweet, okay, another chair shot, oh, weapon shot. It's just, I don't care what you do at this point. I don't think it takes much skill to do what they were doing, and it's just not my thing. I'd rather see Cole embrace what he is, which is an undersized heel, and work like Tully and Gino Hernandez instead of this guy should be going toe-to-toe with Aleister Black. Yeah, it didn't work for me on any level. But I was impressed with Black's nasty plunge through the tables. He should be saving that bump for a WrestleMania moment. Because that thing, that happened at Mania, that thing would have played over and over and over in their highlight reel. Then we get to the main event. Cena Almas, Johnny Gargano, Johnny Wrestling himself, having an incredible match. Timothy, I'll let you have first shot at it. Hello?
Did we lose him?
Maybe.
Huh.
Oh, weird. Sorry about that, guys. That was me. I was actually saying I almost want to let Devin go first on this one. I don't know. Devin, what do you think?
All right, there we go. Boom.
I can go first on it if you want me to. I mean, I don't mind. I mean, I'll take a crack at it.
You're the guest, and this is a kind of important match, you know?
Yeah, okay. This was a pretty special match. It was one of those matches where, I mean, typically I try to pay, I'm one of those people who can't multitask very well. So I typically try to really focus when I'm watching wrestling, but this was like, all right, off of Twitter watching this shit. And,
You don't watch two or three matches at a time like your brother?
No, I'm not that crazy. He's Look, completely
I could never
nuts.
A million years do that.
He's a complete lunatic. I can't remember what spot it was. I think it might have been after Johnny had kicked out of the first DDT, and I looked over at my brother Dustin and I said, "This is one of the best matches I've seen in 5 years. This might be the best match I have seen in 5 years, certainly the best WWE match I'd seen in 5 years, because I was thinking of, you know, Cena, Bryan from SummerSlam 13. And almost definitely the best NXT match I've ever seen. And I would say it's a top 20, top 25 match in the history of the company, in the history of WWE. The story of Johnny and his sort of his redemption run, you know, after Ciampa turned on him in Chicago last year, he was off TV for a few weeks. I think he might have been going through a minor injury, if I'm not mistaken. And he came back and cut a promo and said, you know, he's coming back to go solo on his own. Got the you know, new banging theme song, Rebel Heart, and had a great, awesome opener with Almas at Brooklyn last year. And then they had a rematch on TV that was excellent back in October. You know, he was losing to matches. I think he lost to Eichner, I believe, who got the upset win on him. So did the whole story where he was not able to win because he was struggling to get over the Ciampa turn. And then he finally got these big wins. You know, he got into the number one contendership tournament, beat Ono, won the four-way, and then beat Dream, and then got here. And Almas kind of had his own unique journey of, you know, being kind of miscast as a babyface in the suspenders, and then turned heel. And then Zelina Vega came in and kind of helped him revive his career. And he won the NXT title in a big upset, won the title.
You want to hit on that real quick, Devin? You know, I agree. I think Zelina Vega's actually helped his act a lot. But I thought he started clicking once he started becoming a heel. Vega's just put it over the top by having somebody cut promos for him.
He was already clicking as a heel, but I think his heat and just people getting more into his matches universally were helped by Vega's Vega as his valet.
Yeah.
This match was outstanding. I give it the full five. I really liked the early exchanges with the mat wrestling and kind of the you know, the counters and stuff. All that stuff was meaningful as they were going for their submit. You know, Johnny was going for a submission and Almas was going for the DDT. So, you know, that was meaningful. It wasn't just doing that to fart around. When they got to the ending stretch, there were some great up and down peaks and valleys, drama moments where Johnny had to really fight back. I really loved his concussion selling. It kind of reminded me his concussion selling. And in fact, this match was actually worked almost in almost like an All Japan 90s style. It kind of reminded me of like those Steve Williams Kobashi matches from 93 and 94. Where, you know, Almas was giving, you know, Johnny these brutal spots on the ring apron and the DDT, and Johnny was doing this brilliant, like almost disturbing concussion selling and kicking out and still fighting back, similar to Kobashi, to how Kobashi was in those Williams matches. And the huge comeback with the tope to the back and then stuff like that. And then the Vega interference and the best payoff ever to the Vega interference with Candice jumping the rail and attacking her. That had a massive pop. I was jumping up and down in the living room when that happened because it was such a cool markout moment. I got so invested into the match, and I won't deny it. I've met Johnny Gargano personally a few times, and so there's definitely a connection there to, you know, to root for him being emotionally invested into him and into the character, because the booking has been so good for that character in that journey. And when he got that huge, massive comeback after the first kind of big moment where he was doing the concussion selling and you thought he might win, and almost just kept finding ways to escape the hold, got his foot on the ropes. And and of course, the big finish just kind of drains everything out of you with Almas getting the big victory. I actually like that in a lot of ways. I think almost needed a clean victory in some ways. And of course, the post match with Ciampa coming back and hitting him with a crutch was a great visual. They took some great photos at the end and posted it. And that was a nice way to cap off that night. But
so you don't think Ciampa should have cost him the match? Because three, he lost his whole entire family. He flew out to this thing.
I know.
Chad, who's had double bypass surgery. I mean, they really laid on thick the babyface sap story. And
yeah,
then
they
don't heal. I mean, I'm almost shocked they didn't do it at the finish.
My biggest criticism of this whole storyline is that I don't think the second match should have ever happened.
Okay.
In October. For one, I thought it was, I mean, it was worked very similar to the SummerSlam takeover match, which was great. And the TV match in October was great, but the finish was the exact same with Vega throwing in the Ciampa or the DIY shirt. And I thought it was just too samey. I don't think it was necessary. I think they could have done the same story and told the same story with it being the second match for the title. And if Johnny loses the second match for the title, I don't think it's as quite as disappointing. Now, it doesn't really tie in with the bringing the whole family there. But I think even then, I think it's less, because, you know, when you lose three straight, it's kind of a, oh, man.
That's like two strikes, you're out. I mean, it's
yeah, exactly. Like yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but regardless, it was
we got back to the Super Bowl after three Super Bowl losses, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. There you go. And so that's my biggest criticism of it. And regardless, I still think the match was outstanding and a 5-star classic match. And I think it's a match that will definitely hold up by year's end for match of the year candidate. And possibly will remain that way for the entire year as a match of the year.
Do you feel they chose that finish to go for the integrity of the match of the year contender? Or do you think this is just a story they wanted to tell?
I think it's a story they wanted to tell, although I think that's an interesting question you raise. I do think it's a story that they want to tell, believe it or not. But I would be interested about the idea behind why they actually did that finish. Because, I mean, if Johnny had won, that'd be the best match in the history of the WWE, I think, maybe. But or at least top five. But with him losing, it was a little bit of a disappointment. And I think in some ways that's good, because I was so invested into the character and into the match from a kayfabe perspective, not even just as a, oh my God, this match is great. You know, it's just from a invested into the character and the story kind of deal. I think there's a story behind it here. I definitely think there's a story behind it. I'm a spoiler reader, and I'll leave it at that, because the tapings at this Center Stage the last two nights have happened. So I definitely think there's a story to it.
Yeah, because I'm not a story spoiler reader usually, so I have not read them. Now this Johnny Gargano is a lot different than the Johnny Gargano that was the Dragon Gate ace maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Am I correct? Who's the guy who finally got the light bulb? Because I just never thought Gargano was this great baby face on the indies. I always thought he was a guy who took 80% or took 60-70% of his matches and had really spots, had some unique spots, but never knew how to string them together. And now he's completely done a 360, and he's become a super worker. And I want to know. I know it's got to be the NXT system. I want to know which coach had to have taken him under his wing and like, hey, man, I think your psychology worked so much better this way, and got Gargano to buy into it.
I mean, I think it's pretty obvious she was on the end of the show with him. I mean, he turned into an amazing babyface after he got married to Candace. And, I mean, when you have that level of babyface to live up to as your wife that you don't want to disappoint, I think it'll bring it out of you, man. I mean, that sounds crazy, but I think working with Ciampa really turned around like his commitment to his fitness and his endurance. If you notice that, when they started palling around and being best buddies, his body started to get even better because Ciampa's a fucking fitness freak. And then getting married to
that gym, we were able to go at 24/7.
Right. So I think being best friends with Ciampa and becoming a fitness freak and being married to who was probably one of the best baby faces in wrestling from like 2014 and 2015, the, you know, number one ace of PWG, Candice LeRae, I think helped him kind of learn the babyface game better. But yeah, I just, it seemed like that's crazy to say because he does have this full NXT kind of system behind him, but it feels like those two people are the ones who kind of must have had the biggest effect in his life. I can't think it's coincidence, you know?
Okay, before I get to you, Tim, on the match, one other question. Does NXT have a problem knowing when to pull the trigger on these ultra babyface runs? We saw it was Strong earlier in the year.
Yeah.
Where they kind of demasked, you know, he got over so big, and then nothing. No, I don't want to say nothing, but it's just, yeah, it's just not the same, him and Rude. I mean, that guy program got over huge and actually ruined McIntyre's run. And then we have Gargano here, ultra babyface. Maybe they just don't know how to peak and ebb and flow and pick the timing on when to peak these babyfaces. But my God, both Strong and Gargano have gotten over gigantic as the never die babyface. It gets to like the old school Ricky Steamboats, Rick Martels, and they just don't know the timing of it. Is that a? I'll go with you too first, Tim. What do you think?
Yeah, and I think you could even go back beyond that with Sami Zayn. I don't know that they pulled the trigger on Sami Zayn early enough, and I don't know if they would have pulled the trigger on Sami Zayn if they didn't have Kevin Owens fall in their lap as this perfect storyline to go off of with those two. I actually think that they would have prolonged that even further than they should have. So it's like, there is a history of this that you can see, that they're not pulling the trigger fast enough. And I worry that it's going to get even worse with Gabe involved, because Gabe has a history of doing the same thing.
God, I know.
So it's like, it's scary to say, but it does feel like it's correct. I think that this was the spot here. I agree with Devin that I think that they had a story that they were trying to tell, and one of the most important matches in, like, I don't know, like, one of the most historic, iconic matches that's probably ever going to happen kind of fell into their lap, and they just had, like, a story that they were going to do. But I don't think that this went out there with the idea that they were going to have a match of the year, match of the decade level match. I think that they went out here, they were going to have a good match, but I mean, yeah, I think that NXT has an issue. Devin, I mean, yeah, what do you think? Do you think NXT has an issue with this?
Well, I think part of the problem is what we were talking about a little bit earlier, is they got to move these people up. I mean, they've got major issues. They've got to move people up to the main roster. I think the two main problems is this, is one, the history of NXT about not pulling the trigger or waiting too long for people and keeping them around too long. Like, Balor, I thought, stayed too long in NXT, a little bit too long. I think Nakamura stayed too long in NXT. I think Joe stayed too long in NXT. And that kind of relates to this a little bit. I think they and right now they have these major baby faces on the roster. They have Gargano, they have Roddy Strong, they had they have Black, Aleister Black. They have Drew McIntyre, who's a baby face. You know, I mean, he's hurt right now, but I mean, they have way too many top main event baby faces, and I think they're having an issue of, they don't know who they want to push as a top baby face ace. They're having an issue about deciding who's going to be the guy. I think they're having a very tough time trying to figure out, you know, well, do we want Gargano to be the guy, or do we want Roddy Strong to be the guy, or do we want Aleister Black to be the guy, or do we want Drew McIntyre? I mean, I think they're having a very serious problem with this. And this problem may continue if they have a guy like Ricochet come in and get hot. And then if you're going to keep Gargano or Strong and Black, and you know, if they keep these guys around, that's just going to create more problems. You know, all these signees and stuff. So they're in a really tough situation right now, and I just don't think they've made up their mind on who they want to push as a top baby face. And you know, I think and obviously Triple H has a huge hand, and it's his baby, and he's probably, you know, he's obviously got a huge hand in the booking and the writing and whatnot. And I think part of it is he's a mark for NWA Crockett Mid-Atlantic, and he always wants to have a heel as a champion.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he's always like, and I think he doesn't know, part of it might be Triple H just doesn't know who he wants to have as the, you know, the lead babyface chasing for the title. I just don't think he can make up his mind on that. Or the people who, you know, who are running NXT. I think they just, they can't make up their mind. They push all these guys all the way up to the top, and then they kind of have to pick about, you know, and I think they're struggling to pick which one they want to pick. And then at the same time, it's a farm system. So you've got to have, you know, eventually you just got to move people up, you know, and make room for one guy or two guys, 1A or 1B or whatever, and push them and let these other guys move up to the main roster. You know, Drew McIntyre, when he gets back from injury, you know, he might be able to work one program and NXT, but he needs to go to the main roster. You know, Aleister Black, his character, his gimmick, he's, you know, he's got a main roster potential. And look, move him up. Like, you know, make room for these guys, you know, so that this issue doesn't continue to make things an issue in terms of the booking of the top baby faces. I think that's kind of the central problem, is they just have too many guys up there at top and they can't decide which one they want to use.
And then the main roster has got to kind of weed out some of these veterans who've been around and actually let Randy Orton be putting over the Aleister Black or the,
I know,
something. I mean, cause even though they've been moving these talents up lately in the last year or two, no one's really broken out, and it's almost like the same cat besides Braun, who was never in NXT, really.
No, no. I mean, he was a rosebud.
Yeah. You know, and no one's broken out. At best is Kevin Owens, who is a mixed bag with a lot of people. Sami Zayn's a mixed
bag. I'm so down on him and both right now.
Yeah.
I'm both on them right now.
And, you know, Knack. I mean, Joe's been hurt. You know, so, I mean, they need to kind of realize that maybe, you know, I know Hunter doesn't want to cut bait on Seth Rollins because he put him over. But he wasn't the right guy to put over. A lot of these guys who now have been there, you think of them as young talent, but, man, they've been up there. Even Roman Reigns, those guys have been there. You either got to push them to the moon or cut bait even up top a little bit to freshen up the roster.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
Now, Sam, back to the match.
This match was, I don't even know, like, how to explain it. Okay, up until this point, my match of 2018 was Yukio Sakaguchi versus Speedball Mike Bailey. It was in Yokohama. It was in front of 240 people. And it was an amazing shoot-style strikes and a little bit of grappling, trade back and forth. Fantastic, just wrestling. This match, Gargano versus Almas, could have had, like, zero wrestling moves. And was already better than my current match of the year. It was like the drama, the emotion. This match was made by Gargano selling, the characters clicking, the cockiness of Almas and Vega playing off of each other, Candice LeRae getting involved, the entire family being there, the, like, histrionics of everything and the drama of everything made this match. Like I said, I don't think they expected this to happen. I think everything just came together and clicked in a way that I don't know that anyone could predict. It's very hard to argue with a match like this and how great it is. I think that there's really two different schools of thought. Like I said, my taste, I was looking over the Voices of Wrestling top 100 matches of 2017, and I looked at my ballot, and my ballot had three matches from Jeff Cobb. My top 10 matches of 2018, I found three matches from Jeff Cobb that I all thought were the top 10 matches of the year, because they're great. So it just shows, like, what my taste is. I like beefy grappling, I like hard-hitting, I like shoot-style stuff, and this match had really none of that. But it didn't need any of it to draw out this amazing emotion. And it still did. It still had state-of-the-art wrestling moves. It still had crazy, insane double knees into the face with the bloody lip that's like the official MVP of NXT now, as Gargano's bloody bottom lip. this thing is just the selling, the drama, the magnificence of it. I'm giving it 4.75, 4 3/4 star. I've watched it about 4 times. I can't really pick out any issues with the match. You could almost say it dangles on self-conscious epic, but like I said, I think you would have to be, they would have to have been out there trying to have an epic history-making match to be a self-conscious epic, and I don't think that they were. That's the, I think the craziest part of the match to me is I think that they went out here with the idea that they were going to have a very good match playing off of a lot of drama. And it was going to, that was going to be it. And it's just the story of Johnny Gargano in NXT is that every single time it's supposed to just be this little thing and it turns into something bigger. And I don't know if you can count on Johnny Gargano to deliver like this every time. I don't know if he understands it. But he's got something.
And Johnny Gargano's run, ever since he's been in the tag team with Ciampa, to me, he's been the most important person in NXT.
I agree. Yeah.
I don't think there's any question. And like I said, I want to see where this goes, because I don't know if he even understands how he's become this. It's like the Daniel Bryan, and the comparison to Daniel Bryan is so apt, because Daniel Bryan almost had the aw shucks, this old kind of reaction to the crowds going fucking insane for him.
That's, yeah, and you know, like I mentioned, that was kind of my, you know, my criticism of it a little bit. Like, he was just like, you know, whatever.
Yeah, and I just wonder if there's almost some of that in Gargano. I have to see if Gargano really does understand and can harness this, and if, because if he can understand what it is that connects with the crowd, if he can understand what's that intangible spark that's made this run and made this match what it is, he could become one of the greatest wrestlers in the history of wrestling. But I don't know if he's just lucky, he's just happened upon it, and it's hard to tell at this point where it's going to go.
Yeah, but I hate to use the term luck. I like to use the term maybe lightning striking in a bottle right now.
Right, and that's probably way more fair to say it that way. But I'm, and it's been a long run to even still be this trepidatious about it, but it's really, really impressive the wrestler that he's become. And I think that's kind of what it comes down to. Almas was fantastic. Like I said, the wrestling in this was fantastic, but you could strip almost all of that away. And there was something about Gargano that spoke to, I think, everyone on a real emotional level, just with the selling and the passion and everything there. And you could frame it perfectly, which they did. I mean, with the family and the wife and getting fucked, you know, with the involvement of the outside interference again and losing the match and all of that. The best friend turning on him again. You know, I mean, he already turned on him, but showing up to make it even worse, to rub salt in the wound at this point. All of that was the really great kind of framing that made it even better.
On top of it, too, yeah.
Yeah, but at the core of it, Gargano delivered something that was just completely real and raw. And I think it brought the emotion out of everyone in the crowd, so that having everything else be set up perfectly, it would have just been there. But having him as the kind of the nucleus for the entire thing is what set off the spark to create, I think, one of the most important moments in wrestling. And it's weird to say that, because it's like contemporary, but like I said, I've watched this thing like 4 times at this point, and it doesn't get worse. It just continuously stays amazing, which is like really, really impressive.
So yeah, I thought it was a masterpiece. I gave it the full 5. Again, I would have still had Ciampa interfere because I don't think Cien Almas is ready to lose either. So it was like a match they booked where neither guy should have lost. And if they're going to lose, I think Ciampa should have interfered. It would have made a hurt the match some, yeah, but I'm about business, not about match quality. I love to watch good matches. But I would have done something differently for the finish. But obviously they're telling a different story than I'm maybe wanting to tell at this point. But to me, it was like a hybrid of like a great 80s Steamboat Flair with a hybrid of like All Japan 90s stuff. I mean, how it was rooted with everything I love about pro wrestling. And then it built. And it built. And it built. And it built. And when he thought it couldn't build anymore, it built a little bit more. Everything made sense. Everything, the selling of Gargano, putting everything over. He was this prototype selling of, it was this great pro wrestling selling. Which is funny, because this whole weekend we saw some really interesting selling. We saw Tanahashi's when he's selling the knee bar. And that was like over the top. We saw Gargano here, which was pitch perfect in pro wrestling setting. And then actually one of the Bucks, I bought his selling enough where I actually thought he was legitimately hurt when he was working RPG 3000. This is a point Meltzer brought up in his Observer. And I found it very fascinating on how three different types of selling, all three got over in different facets. But here, I mean, this was just so perfect. But it was just all of the nuances and stuff was just incredible. It was just everything. At that one point when they had that near fall towards the end and the freaking roof exploded and then the heat just went up to another notch to take it to another level. I mean, this was one of those things where you had the perfect crowd for this match. And you got to admit, this isn't Philly, a known jaded crowd. And they got it over with this story of a plucky babyface, which a lot of times in Philadelphia would have got you strung up, ripped apart, rung up the freaking the flagpole and yelled ECW, ECW at. And then they got it over in fucking Philadelphia. They were able to get this story over. God, what a masterpiece. That's all I can say. Because a lot of times this match might have just, if it especially happened in Philly, I can see them just turning on a Johnny Gargano. But because he was so convincing and so good at his role, they couldn't. They bought into the movie they were watching right then and there. And this thing is a master classic. Yeah, full five. Amazing, amazing stuff. Oh, man. Timothy, what do you think of the show overall?
It's almost hard to rate the show because it's so top-heavy. You know, like, the main event is so good.
And I'm going to interrupt you guys real quick, Timmy. I want to ask both of you guys a question first. Were you guys shocked these guys went 35-plus minutes?
I was a little bit, yeah.
Shocked that they got the time or that it was that long?
Yeah, they booked a match to go that long.
I wouldn't have guessed it was that long watching it live. It's very impressive for them to do that. But
yeah, I thought for sure 25 tops, and then they've got 35 minutes to tell that story. That's confidence. What about Devin?
I was a little surprised that they went that long. But at the same time, you know, these are two new guys that are. I mean, like, Almas is like the most fresh NXT champion they've had in a long time.
Yeah.
And these guys are typically guys you would see in the, you know, undercard or mid card. You know, outside of Gargano working with DIY and getting that main event ladder match and the revival feud and stuff. So in ways I was, because I just wasn't used to seeing these guys in the NXT title match and in the main event. Because if you look at the history of NXT title matches, they're typically very long. You know, they're typically 25 to 35 minutes.
Right.
So in ways, it really isn't that surprising. But because of who was in it, I didn't expect to see a 35-minute match.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, well, and another thing about Almas that's impressive is that he's the first guy, when you talk about he's a fresh NXT champion, he's the first guy in a long time that's NXT champion that hasn't really been at that top guy level, even at the company that he worked at before, companies he's worked at before. He's been in, he was in main events in CMLL, but I don't think he was ever treated as the number one top guy. And so that's like another part of this that's fresh for him as the champion, is that that's the kind of new territory for him.
He feels hungry as a champion.
Yeah, and they really haven't had a lot of that, because a lot of the other champions are guys who have been the top guys in their companies before they came into NXT. So yeah, that kind of brings something new to it for sure. Were you asking me about the show overall now, or?
Yeah.
Okay, so show overall, it's really tough to grade the show overall because it's so top-heavy. I did really enjoy most of the show quite a bit. I think it dipped slightly in the middle, but I think that the opener was hot. The top two matches strongly delivered. So yeah, I mean, the show overall is an easy thumbs up. I do want to point out that, while Johnny Gargano was very good, you know, his wife did get 4 stars out of Joey Ryan from me, so that's pretty impressive, too. Devin, what did you think of the show overall?
Definitely easy thumbs up. There aren't bad takeovers. I don't think this is, you know, the main event was a classic, so it's hard to sort of, you know, overall as a whole, it probably isn't the best takeover ever. Although I think there's an argument for it. But it was definitely an easy thumbs up, and it was a great show for sure.
Yeah, I'm with you. I give it an easy thumbs up. It kind of reminds me of like kind of like the, in '89 in the Observer feedback where Russell War got all thumbs up, and it was all based on Steamboat Flair, you know, having a classic. Well, I think Great American Bash 89 was a well more rounded show that they put on in 89. That you know, in hindsight, people look back, and that's how I feel like some of the NXT specials are. Were just more deeper or more well-rounded throughout and had a better show overall. But you remember this one because of the classic match, and this one is a match that people should remember for a long time. Easy thumbs-up show, though. Devin, man, we appreciate you having on, buddy. Do you have anything you want to mention before you head out?
We are taping this on Friday night, and it is, what, February 2nd, Friday night that we are taping this? So my January rankings for WWE should be out by the time this airs, since I plan on posting them in the next hour. So whenever you folks hear this on Monday morning, whereabouts, I guess. I should have my January rankings for WWE out, and that is at wrestlingvirtues.blogspot.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at KingMotivatorH, and my blog is also pinned up there on my profile, so you can find it there.
Cool. Timothy, anything you want to mention?
Oh, no. Just same old, same old. Follow me on Twitter at Lucha Undead.
Yeah, follow me at Titans O Wrestling, and keep an eye out for WorldCast Wednesday when we discuss the comings and goings of world-class championship wrestling. On that note, man, everyone have a great week, great Super Bowl weekend, and we'll see you next time. It's just another